Bring me flowers, bring me hearts, fairy metal with your words.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. This is Bill Redway and I'm delighted to be with you again. I'm bringing you the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday 18th of August. Now, you may remember the music I played on the Red Saturn programme last month, which was a new song from a marvellous collection inspired by Shakespeare and written and recorded by a group of contemporary folk singers led by local musician Jess Distill. This month, I'm playing another song from the CD called Up and Down. It's written and sung by Minnie Birch, who has kindly permitted us to use it on Talking Newspapers. She says, I chose Midsummer Night's Dream as my inspiration. It's a play about love and misunderstandings, full of fairies and twists and turns. The chorus is taken directly from a version of the play I'd read, which sees the mischievous Puck meddling in love lives, whilst pronouncing, Up and down, I will lead you up and down. You'll be able to hear it in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the Hearts Advertiser, the edition published on the 16th of August, and we follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Sue once again. In part two, we have the second of three conversations with key people in the team that brought St Albans its new museum and gallery. Rob Pearman hears from two members of the Trust, Mike Gray and Caroline Eldred, about how the project was delivered and how the all-important funding was achieved. Now, for those of you who may be interested, we'll be arranging a visit to the new museum for our listeners on 9th of October. More details next week. Part three will be Munich, the novel by Robert Harris. It's a spy thriller based on the actual events of 1938, when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain flew to Munich to negotiate with Hitler over the fate of Czechoslovakia. We start with the news, and our readers today are Gilly, Jill, Bob and Fiona.
Hello, I'm Gilly, and I'm leading with a story entitled Is This the Final Nail in the Coffin for Incinerator? London Luton Airport Limited, and I'll call it LAL from now on, has retracted a letter of support for a controversial incinerator its chief operations officer sent without the board having properly discussed it. Chair of LAL, Andrew Malcolm, has written to Harpenden Luton incinerator developer Andy Brewer to withdraw the letter of support written by Robin Porter. Councillor Malcolm's letter reads, The LAL board discussed the matter on Monday, July the 30th, and considerable concern was expressed that a technical letter endorsing your project had been signed without full and proper discussion with the board. Following this meeting and further consultation with board members, it has been agreed LAL should immediately withdraw its letter of support for this project. I would therefore be obliged if you ensure the letter is not used or quoted in any circumstances. LAL is the owner of Luton Airport and the majority shareholder in LAL is Luton Borough Council. The incinerator, also known as the Lee Bank Energy Park, has been proposed for New Mill End in Bedfordshire, north of Harpenden and west of Kimpton, and would produce heat and energy by burning waste. The application to build it by Mr. Brewer's company Emsrain has sparked fierce resistance from Hearts residents who created the Stop Harpenden Luton Incinerator Group. The group opposed the incinerator on the basis of its potential impact on the environment, the health of those living nearby, and the traffic from the heavy goods vehicles travelling to and from the plant. Group leader Tim Armstrong Taylor responded to Councillor Malcolm's letter by saying, "This revelation effectively removes the very special planning circumstances Emsrain explained were key to their obtaining the approval to build the plant in the Greenbelt at a meeting with Wheat Hampstead Parish Council last month. At the meeting, they claimed they had partnership support from the airport and stated in their presentation the plant was sited close to London Luton Airport as an end user of a significant proportion of all the heat and power generated. It was put across at the Wheat Hampstead meeting that the incinerator was relying on Emsrain having the airport as a customer. Now they do not have that and they are not allowed to use the technical letter of support. I think they should withdraw the application." An Emsrain spokesperson said, "The plans for Lee Bank Energy Park are entirely mischaracterised as the Harpenden Luton incinerator. The facility is neither in Harpenden nor Luton, nor is it simply an incinerator, that being something which burns waste with no other benefit. We received an earlier technical letter of support from LAL that recognised the benefits of the Lee Bank Energy Park project to the airport. While these benefits still stand, we have since been asked by LAL not to use this letter." After Mr Porter's letter was sent, Luton Borough Council leader Hazel Simmons said the application was at odds with the council's own energy strategy, which is based on wind and solar energy, and referenced concerns about the possible environmental impact of the incinerator on Luton. Luton Lib Dem leader David Franks, who sits on LAL's board, himself expressed concerns about possible pollution from the incinerator. A spokesperson for LAL said, "A technical letter of support was sent by our officers who were approached by the developers in relation to the potential for this proposal to power the airport and surrounding developments, making clear this was absolutely conditional on impacts to the environment and the community being kept to a minimum. The LAL board has since been able to meet to discuss the proposal in more detail and consider the views of both the general public and sole shareholder Luton Council, which has concerns about its potential impact. Following this meeting and further consultation with board members, it has been agreed LAL should immediately withdraw its letter of support for this project." The spokesperson added, "It is unfortunate the way this has played out and lessons have been learned."
Hello, I'm Jill, and my first article is entitled "Teenager Wins National Diana Award for Supporting Mental Health Charities." A teenager from St Albans has won a national award for her work raising money and awareness of mental health issues. Amy de Castillo, who is 17 and goes to Adefield School in Hemel Hempstead, was presented with the Diana Award in a ceremony last month. The award was established in memory of Diana, Princess of Wales, and is the highest accolade a person aged 9 to 25 can receive for social action or humanitarian work. Amy began campaigning when she completed the National Citizens Service NCS Summer Youth Empowerment Programme in 2017, which she said genuinely changed her life. She went on to volunteer for the NCS Regional Youth Board and raise money for local mental health charities, including St Albans-based teenage suicide prevention group, the Ollie Foundation. At school, she mentors younger pupils and helps support victims of bullying. Amy said, "My own past battles with bullying and the impact it had on my mental health inspired me to try and help other young people. NCS gave me the confidence and skills to share my story and break the stigma many of us feel. Receiving this award has proven that regardless of where you come from, you do matter. The uncontrollable scenarios in life aren't what defines you. It's your action, kindness and compassion. I am so honoured and thankful to NCS and the Diana Award for recognising that. Diana Award winners are presented with their certificates and invited to visit Althorp House, Princess Diana's childhood home. Amy was nominated by Danielle Jennings, the Graduate Engagement Manager at Induis, which delivers the NCS locally. Danielle said, "Amy's dedicated and hard work on the NCS Regional Youth Board has been amazing. She tirelessly supports local social action projects, fundraises and supports her peers, all while dealing with her own mental health demons. She is an outstanding example of a young person selflessly creating positive social change and is thoroughly deserving of this national accolade." And this article is illustrated with a picture of Amy posing with her certificate.
Hello, I'm Bob. Last chance to have your say on Luton Airport expansion plans. A series of public consultations on plans to expand Luton Airport might have ended, but members of the public can still comment online until the end of the month. London Luton Airport Limited, LAL, believes the airport will be able to accommodate between 36 and 38 million passengers per year by 2050 from its existing single runway. The consultation documents present options as to how this could be achieved, as well as outlining LAL's approach to minimising the environmental impact. Luton Borough Councillor Andy Malcolm, Chair of LAL, said, "The consultation events have been very well attended, with more than 1,500 people taking the opportunity to look at our proposals, consider how we are proposing to actively manage environmental impacts, and speak with members of our technical team. We have had many important conversations about how people view the success of the airport and the impact it brings. We have already received a large number of feedback forms and would encourage everyone to continue to send us their views by August the 31st so they can be carefully considered for the future of the airport." There were 19 consultations in total, and the proposed expansion has met with opposition from anti-noise campaign groups who are concerned about the effect on people living under the flight paths. Groups including STAX, that's St Albans Quieter Skies, and LADACAN, Luton and District Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise, have argued that the introduction of the new RNAV navigation system in 2015, which narrowed the flight paths, has concentrated noise over a smaller area and increased disturbance to residents. However, LAL is working on ways of reducing noise disruption by maintaining the current limit on flights between 11:30 p.m. and 6 a.m. and encouraging airlines to adopt quieter aircraft. Councillor Malcolm said, "I would like to thank everyone who has attended a consultation event or otherwise viewed our proposals and provided their comments. At the close of the consultation period, we will carefully consider all responses provided as we seek to identify the preferred scheme to take forward to statutory consultation next year."
Hello, my name's Fiona, and my first story is entitled "Here Be Dragons. Bearded Beast is Found Abandoned in District Car Park." The RSPCA is appealing for information after a bearded dragon was found abandoned in a St Albans car park. The bearded dragon was found in its vivarium in a very public area of the Greenwood Park car park in Carisbrook Road on Wednesday, August the 8th. A member of the public called the RSPCA and then took the bearded dragon to a local reptile specialist, who took him in and assessed that while he is healthy, the vivarium was in poor condition. RSPCA Animal Collection Officer Kate Wright said, "This is a very public area, so we hope someone might have seen something or might know where this bearded dragon has come from. Sadly, the vivarium was in poor condition. The RSPCA do see so many instances of dumped exotic pets, and we think the reasons behind this is often that owners cannot cope with the amount of care that they need. He has now been taken to a specialist boarding establishment where he is recovering before he can be rehomed." Bearded dragons are among the five top species of reptiles that are being collected by the RSPCA inspectors or handed in to their centres. The charity also receives calls for help about corn snakes, terrapins, tortoises, leopard geckos, boa constrictors and royal pythons. RSPCA Exotics Senior Scientific Officer Nicola White said, "The number of calls the RSPCA received about reptiles rose 20% over the past 5 years, and sadly we are regularly being called to collect reptiles like this poor bearded dragon that have been abandoned or neglected, presumably because the owners no longer want them or cannot care for them properly. Reptiles are completely reliant on their owners to meet their welfare needs, and these include the need to be provided with the correct levels of heat, light, humidity, plus an appropriate diet for whichever species they have. They are commonly found for sale in pet shops and online. However, it is sadly often the case that they are handed over to buyers with very little or no information about how to care for them properly or the commitment that is involved in keeping them healthy. If you do find yourself in a situation where you can no longer look after your pet, there are options available. You could contact the original seller or the local reptile rescue centre for help rehoming your reptile if you feel you are no longer able to care for them. Anyone with any information about how this particular bearded dragon came to be abandoned can call the RSPCA." And accompanying the story is a photo of the abandoned vivarium and the snake in a car park in quite a residential area.
This is an article about Cottonmill and Sopwell residents who are petitioning Herts County Council to help oppose any attempts to close a railway crossing. The crossing connects the Auburn Way to Griffiths Way and is used by around 1,000 pedestrians and cyclists every day. Network Rail has previously closed the crossing temporarily due to dangerous behaviour, leaving residents fearful it could be shut permanently. The petition reads, "We, the undersigned, petition the council to work with local residents to stop the much-used Cotton Mill Railway crossing from being closed and instead require Network Rail to put in place all possible and appropriate safety measures and procedures. The petitioners want Network Rail to install flashing lights and self-locking gates and ensure train drivers use their horns on approach to the crossing." Cotton Mill resident Chantal Burns said, "Closing it is going to have a massive detrimental impact on the city and the community. People have family on the other side, so it will split the community. It's going to make a difference to people going to the shops and for kids who cycle to school every day, as the other way around, Cotton Mill Lane, is a really long diversion and a very fast road. So it's a small but really important crossing." Chantal knows of people from as far as Hemel Hempstead who use the crossing, which predates the railway that takes trains from St Albans Abbey to Watford. "We have got some very passionately upset, but also very motivated residents who will do whatever it takes to keep it open," she added. Network Rail recorded 787 separate incidents of dangerous behaviour at the crossing between July the 25th and August the 2nd, 2015, and July the 1st to July the 9th, 2017. The crossing was closed in 2015, but reopened 3 weeks later after an outcry from the county council and residents. A Network Rail spokesperson said, "Cotton Mill Lane level crossing has unacceptable incidents of deliberate misuse. Our priority will always be the safety of those who use it. We continue to work with Hertfordshire County Council and St Albans City and District Council to find an alternative to a level crossing at this location." And there's a picture of teenagers, three of them, misusing the Cotton Mill level crossing.
This article is entitled "Ambulance Service Could Use Volunteer Drivers to Tackle Its Staffing Crisis." Our struggling ambulance service is considering using volunteers to drive frontline ambulances in a bid to tackle a staffing crisis. The unprecedented move by the East of England Ambulance Service, NHS Trust, would see ambulances driven by community first responders, who are volunteers trained to respond to local emergency calls and provide life-saving first aid before an ambulance arrives. In an internal email, the NHS Trust senior leadership says it wants feedback from CFRs on how they could be further used. This includes proposals for them driving frontline ambulances in low acuity patient cases, as well as responding to patient falls. The ideas floated have raised concerns over patient safety, with paramedics questioning what would happen if a patient suddenly deteriorated and needed to be blue-lit to hospital. The NHS Trust does not intend to train CFRs to drive on blue lights. Using the military has also been suggested as an option as the ambulance service looks at how it can plug staffing gaps ahead of winter pressures. An ambulance service spokesman said, "While it is well known that readiness protocols like this exist in the event of extreme circumstances, this is not at all reflective of current planning arrangements. Last winter saw delayed response times trigger a risk summit involving NHS England after claims 40 patients were harmed or died due to ambulance delays over Christmas and New Year. The risk summit identified a raft of key actions, including deploying additional staff and vehicles. Last month, health watchdog the Care Quality Commission rated the NHS Trust as requires improvement, saying it was failing to meet legal requirements when it comes to safety care and treatment, staffing and governance. Despite the overall rating, inspectors said the service's caring was outstanding. The 19 clinical commissioners in the East of England have agreed a six-year contract with the ambulance service, which will see a rise in funding from £213.5 million in 2017-18 to £225 million in 2018-19 and up to £240 million in 2019-20. Capital funding of £6.5 million has also been secured as part of a nationwide funding boost from the Department of Health and Social Care, and will be used to create a network of modern hubs and community ambulance stations at 10 sites, including Stevenage and Hemel Hempstead in Hearts and Luton in Beds.
This article begins with a quote: "We are excited about this year's Books in the Belfry lineup." Helen Pankhurst and Arsenal legend Alan Smith will headline this year's Flamsteed Book Festival. Helen will be talking on September the 1st about her great-grandmother Emmeline and her role as a consultant on the film Suffragette, which stars Meryl Streep. She will also be discussing her new book Deeds Not Words, published to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the Suffragette's great victory, which first gave women the right to vote. The popular book festival, known as Books in the Belfry and held in the picturesque St Leonard's Medieval Church, will be held from Thursday, August the 30th to Saturday, September the 1st. It kicks off on the evening of August the 30th with an appearance from former England, Arsenal and Leicester striker Alan Smith. Smith's autobiography, Heads Up, is out in time for the festival, and there will be the chance to quiz him on Arsene Wenger's successor at Arsenal, as well as his Premier League predictions and England's amazing World Cup run this summer. Best-selling novelist Sarah Vaughan promises an entertaining evening on Friday, August the 31st. She will be discussing how she got into writing and the success of her topical thriller, Anatomy of a Scandal. Others appearing include historical biographer Claire Mully, who will be talking about her new work, The Women Who Flew for Hitler. With the Shakespeare Review Company bringing the curtain down on the festival with a gala evening of West End songs and sketches. Festival spokeswoman Vicky Orvis said, "We're excited about the lineup and hope as many people in the area will once again support Books in the Belfry, as all proceeds go to the village charity, which is helping to save the church. We've tried to make sure there is something for everyone, and it promises to be fun, whatever age you are. There are even cream teas too." Tickets for all events are available on the Flamsteed Book Festival website at www.flamsteadbookfestival.com, where you will also find details of the programme and authors and where to buy tickets in person. There will also be a box office at this weekend's Scarecrow Festival in the Village and at Redbourne Library. Cream teas will be available in the church grounds on the afternoon of Saturday, September the 1st, whether you attend sessions or not. Harpenden Books and Waterstones are supporting the festival and will be selling books throughout. And there are two pictures here, one of Helen Pankhurst and the other of the former Arsenal striker Alan Smith.
And now on to another event, Art in Clay. Europe's most prestigious ceramic arts festival is set to fire the imaginations of pottery enthusiasts in Hertfordshire. Internationally renowned ceramicists will display their work alongside innovative new talent at the 24th Art in Clay at Hatfield House this week. The annual event will bring together a record number of more than 200 ceramic artists when it opens its doors on Friday, August 17th to Sunday, August 19th. Art in Clay showcases the finest ceramics currently being created by individual makers in both the UK and Europe. Show director Hannah Ault says, "Thanks to shows like the Great Pottery Throwdown, the world of ceramics is increasingly high profile. Art in Clay is a great introduction to the amazing world of contemporary ceramics, as visitors can chat to the artist, learn from their experts, and even try their own hand in the clay creation zone. The ceramic art world is vibrant and thriving, and it is testament to the prestige of Art in Clay that for serious ceramic collectors, it is a must-visit annual event. In addition to the 200 exhibitors showcasing their art, a full daily programme will include a host of activities. Art in Clay is open from 10 o'clock to 5:30 p.m. on Friday and Saturday and from 10 till 5 p.m. on Sunday. Admission costs £11 for adults, £10.50 for concessions and £19 for a two-day ticket and £27 for a three-day ticket. Children under 15 will go free."
Now this will certainly appeal to some people. You can relive Frank Sinatra's golden age at the Auburn Arena next month. The UK's only Sinatra-based concert production to be endorsed by the president of Sinatra Music Society comes to St Albans on Thursday, September the 20th. Sinatra, Sequins and Swing, The Capital Years Live is a joyous celebration of some of the most iconic music and Hollywood glamour of the 1950s and stars two of the UK's most talented swing vocalists along with the Capitol Orchestra. The show focuses on bringing to life Sinatra's Capitol Records days from 1953 to 61 and its legendary songs, most notably those arranged by the superstar arrangers Nelson Riddle and Billy May. Starring vocalists Kevin Fitzsimmons and Kitty LaRoe, Sinatra Sequins and Swing also recreate scenes from Sinatra's TV and film appearances during that period, like the One for My Baby Bar scene, the Lady is a Tramp nightclub scene from Pal Joey, and You're Sensational from High Society with Grace Kelly. And this article is also accompanied by two pictures, one of Kitty LaRoe and one of Kevin Fitzsimmons.
The Moonlight Walk is a night to remember. Rennie Grove Hospice Care's Moonlight Walk around St Albans takes place on Saturday, September the 15th. The 10-mile route promises a night to remember and is the perfect way to celebrate the lives of loved ones. The route starts and finishes at Westminster Lodge in Holywell Hill and includes a visit to the grounds of Grove House, adjacent to St Albans City Hospital, where there is an opportunity to place a padlock on a memory fence as a symbol of remembrance. Clodagh Kelly, her family and friends will be walking for a third time. Clodagh explains why the Moonlight Walk is so important to them. On Saturday night, September 8th, 2016. My husband John grinned at me smugly from the couch and said cheerio and raised his glass of Shiraz as I swished regretfully towards the front door in my waterproofs. "You're mad," said my daughter Shona as I stepped out into the rain. She has a point, I think, as I pull into Westminster Lodge car park. However, as I join the group, all here to support a friend who has lost a loved one to cancer, and meet the masses of other walkers, we are all infected with a sense of unity and fun, ready to take on Rennie Grove's Moonlight Walk. Saturday night, September the 23rd, 2017, the kids and I are in Westminster Lodge for the Moonlight Walk, surrounded by family and friends. It looks similar, only this time there is no John waving me off this time. The children and I are among those who have lost a loved one. John had died just a month earlier. He'd been diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus in January, and his health deteriorated through the year. Thanks to Rennie Grove nurses, John came out of hospital and spent his last day at home before he died peacefully in the arms of his family. On Saturday night, September the 15th, 2018, we will be at the Moonlight Walk again, walking in John's memory and in infinite gratitude to Rennie Grove that we were able to fulfil his last wish to die at home. The care that Rennie Grove provided was priceless, and they have continued to be there for us with advice on practical issues and bereavement support. So we will walk again this year, hoping to raise more money to ensure that Rennie Grove can continue to help people at the end of their lives and their families. Please visit our Just Giving page and help us raise funds. And there is a picture here of Clodagh Arkellig and John on their wedding day.
This is a rather gory article, not for the faint-hearted, under the series Yesterday Once More. And the heading is Flashback to Murder of 100 Years Ago. On the afternoon of Friday the 16th of August 1918, Jonas Ellingham, station master of London Road Station, was brutally murdered by his wife with a railway hammer whilst taking his midday nap. Jonas Ellingham was a devoted and hard-working station master for the Great Northern Railway, Hatfield to St Albans branch line, writes Peter Wares. But when he did not appear on duty after his midday meal to flag off the 2:45, the booking clerk became a little concerned for his health and well-being, as he had heard that his wife had on occasions threatened to do him in. However, it was not until his daughter arrived home later that day and found the house locked up that staff became alarmed. Luckily, one of the station staff was able to procure a ladder, and the goods clerk was able to enter the house by one of the upper windows and let the others in by the front door. As soon as they entered, they noticed a strong smell of gas in the scullery where Mrs. Ellingham was found, huddled in a corner. While she was being attended to, the station's chief booking clerk, Mr. Archer, went into the sitting room upstairs and found Mr. Ellingham lying dead on the floor with wounds to the head and blood on his face, with a blood-spattered hammer lying in the coal scuttle. Having murdered her husband, Mrs. Ellingham then tried to take her own life, as she believed she would be hanged for her crime. At her trial, Eliza was found to be totally insane and unfit to enter a plea, and the judge ordered that she should spend the rest of her life at Leavesden Mental Asylum. Today, the station and forecourt are used as a children's nursery. And there's a black and white photograph alongside the article of London Road Station today.
Budding nature detectives are invited to Sandridge Forest to solve a mystery and take part in woodland activities. And before I tell you more about that, I'm going to paint the picture with the photograph that accompanies this article. There's a lovely little fella, about 6 or 7, in a stripy blue and white top, sitting in a meadow with a large magnifying glass, examining creatures on buttercups and things like that. The Nature Detectives event is organised by the Woodland Trust and will take place at Hartwood Forest on Wednesday, August the 22nd and Thursday, August the 23rd. There will be activities for the under 13s, including solving a whodunit, whittling, den building and badge making. Danielle Wesley of the Woodland Trust said, Are you ready to solve a wild mystery? The animals have gathered for a picnic in the woods, but a huge hazelnut cake has gone missing. It's been eaten, and all that's left is a pile of crumbs. Nature detectives, we need you to solve the case and track down the cake-eating culprit. The event takes place from 9:45 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. and is £5 for adults, with children going free. If you're interested, please look on the Woodland Trust internet site.
An evening of vintage fun and frivolity is being organised to celebrate Harpenden Public Halls' 80 years. On September the 28th, 1938, one of the most iconic buildings in Harpenden was opened. There is a stone-carved date embedded in the wall by the entrance, reminding visitors of this. To help celebrate the public hall's turning 80 next month, the venue is hosting a number of events, including the return of the Dambusters Ball, a fantastic wartime celebration with live music, dancing, cocktails, vintage vehicles, period costume, comedy and food. The ball will take place on Friday, September the 28th, exactly 80 years since the building was opened. Put on your glad rags and party like it's 1938 with the help of 14 actors and a live 17-piece Glenn Miller-style band. A canteen team of chefs and staff will serve a delicious two-course wartime meal of bangers and mash and mushy peas in army-issue mess tins, followed by a sumptuous spotted dick and custard. Entertainment includes a fantastic George Formby, played by Ewan Wardrop, who has toured the country extensively with his one-man theatre play On George, the vocals of an Andrew Sisters-style trio called The Bouncing Bombs will evoke the romance of that era. To acknowledge 100 years of the RAF and the 75th anniversary of Operation Chastise by 617 Squadron, more commonly known as the Dambusters, the star prize for the raffle is a half an hour flight in a Yak 52 aircraft, with all proceeds going to the sterling work of the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. Bob Golding, who is involved in the event, said, "It promises to be a true highlight of the year for Harpenden and is always a night to remember." Tickets for the ball cost £65 plus a transaction fee, and they are on sale at www.harpendenpublichalls.co.uk or from the box office on 01582 767 525. Now, 2 days earlier, on Wednesday, September the 26th, Harpenden Public Halls will host a special afternoon screening of the classic 1938 war film The Dawn Patrol, starring Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone. Tickets cost £5 and the film starts at 2 p.m. And there's a picture taken outside Harpenden Public Halls, and it's a couple of vintage army vehicles and a car which I'm sorry to tell you I have no idea what it's called.
Now, more news of the Hertfordshire Motor Show, where visitors will have the opportunity to view the latest cars from a wide selection of manufacturers, forms part of the larger Nebworth Classic Motor Show, which celebrates its 28th anniversary this year. The event, held in the grounds of Nebworth House, is set to welcome up to 1,000 classic cars and collectible vehicles on Sunday and Monday, August 26th to the 27th. As well as saloons, sports, American, commercial, military and classic vehicles all going on display, there will be a live arena which hosts a series of parades and interviews. There's also plenty of activities for families with admission to the Nebworth Fort and Gardens included in the admission price. Ian Frey, Managing Director at Classic Line Insurance, which is this year's headline sponsor, said, "The Nebworth Classic Motor Show has everything for the perfect day out. There's plenty for all to enjoy. Hundreds of classic cars, a live arena, plus the attraction of the fort and gardens." And this is accompanied by two pictures of the exhibits. One is a Ford Galaxy and the other is a Chevrolet Corvette.
This article is about a gardening prize. A woman has donated £1,000 to charity after winning first prize for the prettiest rose at a St Albans garden centre. Maggie Phillipson won the prize at Aylett Nurseries in St Albans and was presented with a cheque for £1,000. 30 garden centres throughout the UK took part in the contest, and the winner from each centre was entered into the Sun newspaper's national competition and judged by a gardening team. The cheque presentation was attended by Peter Seabrook, MBE, from Sun Gardening, and Aylett Nurseries Managing Director Julie Aylett. Maggie, who has been tending her tequila sunrise rosebush for 24 years, chose to donate her prize money to Noah's Ark Children's Hospice. Julie said, "We are absolutely delighted to present Maggie with a cheque for £1,000 and overwhelmed by her generosity in donating the money to a truly worthy charity." And there's a nice picture of a group of people, including Maggie Phillipson receiving her cheque, taken at Aylett's nursery, it looks like.
And finally, a mural has been painted outside a tuition centre in St Albans to raise money for rare birds in the Galapagos Islands. Bright Young Things, which is based at 12 Richmond Road at the back of the St Albans station, has organised to have the mural of blue-footed boobies and flamingos painted across the side of the centre to raise money to protect the endangered boobies island home. Woody Webster, the director of the centre, said, "We had a white wall outside Bright Young Things and we wanted to brighten the area up. We've had people walking in saying, 'We love your wall.' I designed it and got a painter to paint it. The blue booby is such a rare creature and it's only in a very small part of the world." At the centre, staff are raising money through fundraising events and by selling blue socks. Woody admitted, "Everyone loves flamingos, but flamingos and blue-footed boobies do not usually live together, so actually I'm ecologically incorrect."
A look now at radio programmes broadcast from Monday to Friday in the week ahead.
This is the Talking Newspaper radio listings from Saturday 18th of August to Friday the 24th of August 2018. On Saturday the 18th of August, programmes on Radio 3 are highlighting the Eurovision Young Musicians 2018 competition from Edinburgh, and these continue all through the afternoon and early evening, and also on Sunday. The final is at 2 p.m. on Friday the 24th of August. The BBC Proms also continue on Radio 3, and at 7:30 p.m. there is an all-Ravel prom from the Royal Albert Hall featuring the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Simon Rattle. On Classic FM at 9 p.m, Humphrey Burton continues his celebration of Leonard Bernstein, tonight exploring jazz featuring Benny Goodman on clarinet. On Sunday 19th of August, for the 150th edition of the acclaimed programme The Reunion on Radio 4 at 11:15 a.m, Sue McGregor brings together five people who have survived the Nazi concentration camp Auschwitz. While for something a bit lighter, at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4, the comedy creator Henry Normal takes a look at imagination and the reasons why people create with his own brand of comedic experiences. Following that, at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4, is a new series of Anika Stranded, the crime drama featuring the detective wit of Annika Strandhed, Queen of the Oslo Police Boat Patrol. This first episode of 8 is read by Nicola Walker.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. Coverage of the third test match between England and India at Trent Bridge is being broadcast from Saturday until Wednesday. Programmes begin at around 10 a.m. on Radio 4, and all through the afternoon until around 7 p.m. and also on Radio 5 Live Sports Extra. The BBC Proms season continues through the week on Radio 3 with most afternoon concerts at 2 p.m. and most evening concerts at 7:30 p.m. The composer of the week is Leonard Bernstein, but due to a prom concert on Monday, he's featured this week from Tuesday onwards in the 1 p.m. slot on Radio 3. The book of the week on Radio 4 FM at 9:45 a.m. is The Freedom Papers. In collaboration with the Edinburgh International Book Festival, five writers reflect on a modern definition of freedom. At 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4, Alexander McCall's Smith drama, 44 Scotland Street, returns with his own adaptation of his novel following the lives of the residents of a tenement in Edinburgh's new town. And not for the faint-hearted, the book at bedtime this week is Jaws. Peter Benchley's 1974 blockbuster is read by Henry Goodman. Good luck.
And now some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday, the 20th of August, Indigo Children by Hannah Silver is the drama on Radio 4 FM at 2:15 p.m. Jamie Winston plays Lydia, a parent who refuses to accept her daughter Roz is on the autism spectrum. Roz is played by Lizzie Clark, an actress with Asperger's syndrome, who set up a campaign which encourages disabled people to follow their path. On Tuesday, the 21st of August, historian Peter Hennessy concludes his series of interviews where he asks senior politicians to reflect on their life and career with former Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith. That's at 9 a.m. on Radio 4. On Radio 4 FM at 4:30 p.m. in Great Lives, Matthew Paris invites actress Patricia Green, a.k.a. Jill Archer in The Archers, to share her admiration of Elizabeth, Countess of Shrewsbury, 1527 to 1608, more commonly known as Bess of Hardwick. At 8 p.m. on Radio 2, singer Jamie Cullum showcases his love of jazz from heritage tracks to contemporary sounds. The essay Five Screen Goddesses on Radio 3 at 10:45 p.m. has Betty Davis as the fifth subject being highlighted by series presenter Sarah Churchwell. On Wednesday, 22nd of August at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 in the series Prime Minister's Props, presenter David Cannadine visits Chartwell, Churchill's country home, to explore how Churchill's cigar became synonymous with his image during the Second World War. The Radio 4 drama at 2:15 p.m. is Tommy's. The date is the 22nd of August 1918, and a shocking secret is discovered about the US 371st Regiment, currently in the front line at Essen-on-Argonne. Written by Patricia Cumper and Jonathan Ruffle, with a cast headed by Claire Perkins as Mrs. Washington.
Still on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m, multi-award comedy writer Sarah Kendall begins a new series of her storytelling show, Australian Trilogy, Volume 2, a collection of seemingly unconnected stories and memories. In this episode, entitled 73 Seconds, she looks back at her childhood. On Thursday, the 23rd of August, another of Alexander McCall Smith's books is dramatised for the Radio 4 drama at 2:15 p.m. It's The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. There is a second story on Friday, the 24th of August, at the same time. At 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, a comedy by Ben Cottam and Paul McKenna called Plum House is about the inept and eccentric staff at Plum House, the former country home of 18th century poet George Pudding. This episode of Six is YYWI, centred around the preparations for the annual visit of the Women's Institute. On Friday, the 24th of August, in a new series of The Now Show at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, the team returns to Edinburgh with another helping of satirical silliness from the world's biggest arts festival. An evening with Burt Bacharach at 8 p.m. on Radio 2 rounds off the week with a concert from July at the Royal Festival Hall, where he conducts the orchestra from his piano and is joined by three vocalists to perform hits from his vast, enduring songbook.
we continue with today's bereavement notices. Here are the names of people and their ages, if published, who have died recently and whose names are recorded in the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Sally Smith, Sheila Walton, 94, Olive May Wiseman, 103, Anne Dines, Anne Austin, Joseph Allwood, Andrew Barkus, 68, Angela Edna Clements, 77.
In this short series looking at the new museum and gallery in the heart of St Albans, I chatted last time with Catherine Newley, Audience Development Manager at both Verulamium Museum and the new one. Catherine explained the history of the former Museum of St Albans on Hatfield Road, now closed, of course, and being redeveloped as homes and flats. And she also looked at the history of the Town Hall, including the courtroom and the police cells. Now, the Town Hall overlooking the marketplace in St Albans is the site of the new multi-million pound museum and gallery. I'm joined today by two members of the trust that has a major responsibility for what is, I guess, the largest building project in this city since the cathedral, or one of them, certainly.
Yeah, I'd have thought so, yeah.
Well, Mike Gray is chairman of the trust and Carolyn Eldred is a member of the trust, a trustee, and they have, in fact, been involved in this project for several years, I think. Can you remember when you got involved first?
Yes, I got involved in November 2011 when the council were looking at options of the museum in Hatfield Road versus the town hall.
Because the museum in Hatfield Road was then beginning to be considered as great in the 19th century. You got through the 20th century, but it really wasn't terribly...
really fit for purpose. We tried to generate more footfall into it by opening up an art gallery in the front of it. But although that did increase numbers, it only increased them to sort of 15,000 per annum. Whereas when we looked at the town hall, we expect that we're going to get conservatively 15,000 a month. 200,000.
200,000.
Roughly.
Okay, yeah, that's good. We'll come back to the targets perhaps later. You've got a museum, which is the Museum of St Albans, been there for a long time. It's not fit for purpose. You say, okay, we'll look at the town hall, but it can't be as simple as that.
No, it's not as simple as that. I mean, the council were admittedly under pressure because of government funding cuts in terms of trying to reduce their expenditure. And they had a building to maintain in Hatfield Road, which was, as you say, wasn't fit for purpose. It was old. And they've got a town hall building that, again, has become sort of less used and was really just famous for its coffee shop in the front and book sales every year in the courtroom.
Changing its use all the time. You're never quite sure what it was there.
You're never sure what it was. And it wasn't really, you know, it's in the centre of town. It's got a massive footfall going past it, 4 million, a conservative estimate again. And so, you know, they were thinking, well, let's do something about this. And they realised, because the trust wanted a bigger project to be involved in, they realised that the trust was a good way and a good medium for raising funds.
Let's go back to the trust. Carolyn, the trust was originally what? It was created for the Verulamium Museum, is that what you said?
Yes, it was created in 1994 as the Verulamium Museum Trust, and that was in order to help to raise funds for the Verulamium Museum extension. It's very much easier as a charitable trust to raise money than for the council to just go and find money, because if they apply to other charities for grants, they will often be rejected because they like to give to other charities. Also, as a charity, we can claim gift aid, etc.
So as a charity, you'd already been working on one fundraising and development project down
yes,
at the Roma Museum.
And additionally, I think perhaps in the early 2000s, it was before I started joining in, they worked on the Hypercourse development as well. They've done a couple of big projects, and then there was a bit of a fallow time.
And so the council then came to the trust and said, we've got some thoughts about these buildings, and they brought you in then as a necessary partner.
They brought us in as a partner, because not only could we raise funds, our trustees have got a wide expertise and experience in those sorts of projects. So they wanted help, and we said we were up for it.
So time-wise now, we're talking 2011 was what you...
So that was
in
November 2011 when we started to look at different options. And then we, with the council and the University of Hertfordshire, who are a partner to the project as well, put together an application to the Heritage Lottery Fund for funding. That first application was in 2012, and we were rejected rejected, but invited to apply again. So we applied again, and then in August 2013, we submitted a fundraising request for $2.8 million, and in November 2013, we were advised we were successful. And so that then kick-started the project, because although the Heritage Lottery Fund say, yes, we're happy with your project and we will give you the money, you've then got to go through a period of getting permission to start a development phase of the project to really bottom out all the costs, make sure you've got enough contingencies, make sure you've got the right overall designs, make sure you're going to get planning permission because it's a Grade 2 star listed building, so potentially you need Secretary of State approval. You've got to get all the staff together, brief them what's going on. You've got to persuade the trustees that it's a good project to get involved with.
And when you go to the lottery with that sort of proposal, what level of detail are you having to give them then? Do you have to say, we know exactly what we want to do with this, or just, we've got this concept?
At the first phase, when you're applying for your money for your development phase, they don't need a huge amount of detail, because they expect that during your development phase, you will then get the architects involved, who will then start designing it in detail. You will then start looking at your builders who are going to come in and do it. So they expect you to have a certain amount of detail, but not to know exactly where every nail is going to go.
But that's not a returnable £2.8 million. You've got that. You've been given that.
They've pledged it. Yes. They've pledged it.
Okay.
And what they do is they appoint a team and a mentor and a monitoring officer. Once you've gone through that development stage, then they release that money over the period of the project. Some of the money is, in fact, for post-opening, so where you need to train extra staff or recruit extra staff. That will be built into that cost that they will then fund.
For the development phase, they give you a percentage of the money. At the end of the development phase, when you've reached REBA stage D of your architectural plans, you then have to go back to the Heritage Lottery Fund and submit another application for your phase two, which is your build phase. You can be turned down at that point, but if you're successful, then they will say yes, you can then start to apply to release the rest of the $2.8 million.
So our application to the Heritage Lottery Fund was deemed successful in November 2013. We went through that period of permission to start, and then we started to fundraise in 2014. And our first fundraiser was a talk to one of the local St Albans U3A groups. They very kindly gave us a cheque for £40. And so we thought, right,
we're on our way.
It's 1.69 million to go. Heritage Lottery Fund gave 2.8. The council have pledged 3.25. So we were tasked with raising 1.7 million of the 7.75 million project. And as of today, we have £250,000 to go. If we haven't got that, that won't stop the museum opening, because there are various ways we can fund that and then raise the funds later. We've had loads of different things, from talks to organising discos to applications to trusts. What we did as a fundraiser outside town hall was do a selfie thing, spelt C-E-L-L-F-I-E. And so we got people to donate, and we took their photographs with prison uniforms on. But one of the biggest fundraisers has been the Honours Board scheme, where for a donation of £250 and above, we would recognise the donor or his family or whoever the person wanted on a board that is going to go up in the undercroft between the new basement and the cells. And that has been really successful. We've raised over £360,000 on that. We've got nearly 1,400 names from over 1,000 donors. One, it's been a good fundraiser. Two, it's been a good communicator, because people have been inspired by that. They also then know what's going on with the project. We've had quite a lot of support from local corporates through the Chamber of Commerce, people like Sopwell House. One of our fundraisers coincided with their Pearl anniversary dinner, and that raised us a net £72,000. And then we've got lots of other local corporates. They've all done fundraisers for us, quiz nights, or we've become part of their corporate social responsibility programme for a year or two. And that engages them, and it also, again, communicates the project out there as well. We've always tried to attend the events in the marketplace, like the food festival, the Auburn festival.
We were at the Christmas market, what, a couple of years, and what do you do there? What are you promoting? You just
promote.
Yeah, we're promoting the honours boards mainly. One year, the museum team were there selling products from their shop, including their Verilanium rubber ducks.
A lot of it is about communication, because, I mean, the HLF want you to communicate the project to people so that they know what's going on. Caroline's been out talking to local groups like the local WI and other groups like that, U3A, gets the project over and helps people come along with it.
Who came up with the design concept? I mean, you've got an idea, you know what you want to do there, and it's a museum and a gallery, and you then have to go to an architect with more than that. You have to say, this is what we want to achieve, or do you go with a blank sheet and say, what should we do with this space?
Well, you can't go with a blank sheet because it's a Grade 2 style listed building, so there are certain things that you can and can't do. You need to go to an architect that's sympathetically done that sort of thing before.
So did you make this a competition?
Went out to tender, and most of the work that's done under the project has to go out to tender. That's part of the Heritage Lottery Fund rules, and also part of council rules as well. So for projects over certain sizes, they have to go into the marketplace. That went to tender, and John McCaslin and partners, who had designed the King's Cross station, were the winners for that phase. Although we are giving our expertise to the project for that sort of thing and that appointment, because the Heritage Lottery Fund see the council as the lead manager of the project, if you like, because it's their building. They will do all that appointing and all that sifting. We set up what was a programme board or project board at that time, and we were aware of what was going on and we can have our input. But that detailed decision of who to appoint and what the cost would be was really managed by the council in conjunction with the Heritage Lottery Fund.
What's the role of the University of Hertfordshire in this?
They curated the art gallery that was in the old museum, and in order to get them to participate and to continue doing that, providing their curatorial expertise for the contemporary art, they would get them to come along and join in with this project as well.
I've often got confused because what was in Hatfield Road was a museum, and then you added this gallery to it. So is that the sort of idea that you can carry on now into the new project, that it's going to be both a museum of a particular period, but then a gallery for contemporary? Is that what you're saying it's going to be?
Yeah, mainly contemporary art. But I mean, sometimes the museum will put on an exhibition that displays their collection of art, because within the museum's collection they have a large number of watercolours and prints and things like that, mainly about St Albans. So at some point they might bring those out and display them. So the museum's not going to be about any particular period of time, but it will be about St Albans and its history and just bringing out different aspects of that. And sometimes you might combine that with contemporary art. So some work has been done over the past few years with some artists, Lyndall Phelps, Katie Gillam Hull and Abby Spendlove, and they have been inspired by certain aspects of the collection, such as the Salomon tool collection, and they have created new art in response to that. So it's very much about that aspect of the museum. Will be very much about mixing what is in the collection, but looking at it from a completely different angle by an artist and who might create new pieces to go with it.
So the content is going to keep evolving all the time. It's going to be changing. It's not a static exhibition type museum.
Definitely not. No. In the old lobby area of the town hall, there'll be the St Albans timeline. So the timeline itself will be fixed, but there'll be changing artefacts around that to demonstrate different bits of the St Albans history. But if you can imagine the town hall, there's lots of areas. There's the grand staircase, there's the courtroom, there's the cells, there's a new learning space being developed.
What's the learning space? What's
that's that? For education. Right. So we're hoping, as we do in Verulamium, is to have school trips and school children using and learning in that space, and also opening it up in the evenings as well. So, for example, you could do something like drink and draw for adults in the evening.
What's that gallery along the side that you see?
Part of the architect's brief was to create something that looked really wow, and as I think we might have said before, it's quite difficult in a Grade 2 style listed building, and so what they came up with was the glass wings on the Chequer Street and Marketplace sides, which we would knock through at the back. That was the plan, so you can walk out of the new lift and walk all the way round and see the views up St Peter Street, down towards the clock tower and the cathedral, and on the other side up St Peter Street and down towards Holywell Hill. And we had to get planning permission for that, and we had to get Historic England permission for that, and with the support of the Civic Society we got it, and we are obviously biased, but we think it's very good.
Yeah. It's going to be a great asset from the inside looking out.
Yes. Mm. And you can use the walls within those galleries to display artefacts. You can look from the gallery into the building as well, so you can look through the atrium that's above the courtroom.
The courtroom is going to be retained in its present shape and size.
Yes. The only thing we've done to the courtroom really is to change it from 4 levels to 2 levels. We've also dug out a new basement area, so we've got nearly 200 square metres of display space in a new basement that's been dug out under the front reception, and there's a new undercroft being built from the new basement under the courtroom to link up with the existing undercroft that came from the cells into the courtroom, so you can now walk through underneath as well.
How accessible is this going to be to people for whom walking is not the easiest thing in the world?
Well, there is a new lift that goes from the first floor all the way down to the basement. On the first floor, as Mike was saying, we've put the new glazed links in. Previously, if you wanted to get from the assembly room to the rooms at the back, you had to go downstairs and back up. Now you can just do it all on one level all the way around. The same on the ground floor, that's accessible all the way around. The only bit that will be more difficult to get to will be the old prison cells, because there's about three steps up. And being an old building, there was no way round that bit. But every other part of the building will be accessible to people who have got mobility issues.
And is it also going to be free entry?
It will be free entry. What we may have to do is, because we can now buy in exhibitions, whereas we couldn't do that before, and we can buy them in because we can secure them and we can control the temperatures, there is a cost to buying those in, and there may well be three or four a year where we just charge a nominal charge for access.
We mentioned some of the difficulties that you must have encountered with the building because it is greatly lifted. There was asbestos which you had to solve, get all that solved. Mm-hmm. Was it something that you could overcome at each step?
One of the clever things we did at the beginning was to create an advisory board, which was a representation of what we termed our critical friends. So we invited the Civic Society to be on it, we invited the Architectural and Archaeological Society to be on it, we invited some local residents to be on it, and we brought them along with the project. So instead of the usual impression of those societies are that they try and stop things, we made it so that they were part of the success that would happen if we got it all through. So we had good advice from them, we had great architects.
Because of its location right in the centre of St Albans, it's obviously going to attract people more easily than even Verulamium, which is a wonderful museum, but it's not in the centre. And it may well help to cause people to be in that museum first, then to walk to the cathedral, then down to the Verulamium. It sort of becomes a route.
That is one of the plans behind the project, actually. It's sort of St Albans' roots into history. You start at the town hall, and you can't miss this great big white building in the centre of the town. You go in there, find out about St Albans, and then you can walk to the cathedral and then down to Verulamium along the way, looking at some of the other magnificent buildings that we've got, medieval buildings and things.
So do you think it really is going to help to lift St Albans?
I think because we're only 20 minutes from St Pancras, you know, it takes you that long to get across London. They need to, you know, really leverage up on that fact that, you know, why spend an hour trying to get across London to a museum, jump on a train, get to St Albans in 20 minutes.
And on market days, the front will be all noisy and shouting like in the Middle Ages? I mean,
It won't be that noisy and shouting, because, I mean, there won't be any cattle there.
Yeah.
I mean, for the two days a week, most weeks, and 3 days, when obviously there's a farmer's market. Yeah, I think it will, because I think it will encourage people. People don't have to go and spend 3 or 4 hours in the museum. They can pop in and just take a piece of it, you know, I mean, just one of the exhibitions. Because there's so many spaces there, exhibitions will be changing lots and lots of times. So you can go in for your lunch, pick up a coffee, go and sit, and then come out again and go back and come out and go back and come out.
Have you got other ideas for what the spaces can be used for? Is it going to be available to the public to hire for events or to corporate clients, or what have you got?
Very much part of the business plan to ensure that the museum is successful going forward is that we are able to hire out the spaces for corporates, events, maybe weddings, birthday parties, things like that.
Because you will need an ongoing income.
Definitely.
If you go back to the beginning, you're thinking the local authorities in a situation where its resources are being squeezed, and then here they've got two buildings and you've resolved that. The one is helping to fund the other in many ways, but also easing the process. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be ongoing cost to maintain that. And yet you're making it free to residents and others.
The council cross-party, I believe, has committed to continue paying towards the museum service. But the amount that they can afford to put in isn't sufficient to put on all the fantastic ideas that the museum team have got. So in order to help with that, they need the extra money to come in to help pay for the exhibitions, things like that. But as a trust, we will then continue to support the museum service by applying for grants and doing fundraising to help them as well.
So the trust will go on when this project is finished, because you started as a trust for the Verulamium Museum and you've moved into this and you're responsible as a trust. You have responsibilities in both now.
So we are called the St Albans Museums and Galleries Trust. There's the Verulamium Museum, the Town Hall, the Clock Tower and the old General Lee House. So we will raise funds to support all of those things.
There's a lot of work involved in everything that you've done here, and you're obviously very enthusiastic about it, but crikey, this is your lives and you've focused
on. We one of the things we have to report to the HLF is the number of volunteer hours that are spent on the project. We're not the only volunteers, obviously. The museum have volunteers that help them pack and move stuff out from one location to another. Caroline and I reckon we spend each, on average, about 3.5 days a week on the project. And there are other trustees who, apart probably from Annie Brewster, probably spend a bit less, but she is the council portfolio holder, but she's also the council nominated trustee. So she sits on our board of trustees, and she is obviously very active and promotes the project as well as promoting lots of other things for the council. Would we do it again? I probably would, but I think I didn't quite realise at the beginning what a momentous task raising 1.7 million was going to be. The anecdotal advice we got was, well, it won't be too difficult. You know, St Albans, money, that sort of thing. It's turned out to be a bit more difficult than anybody ever thought.
I think I probably would do it again, maybe not for a few years.
It's also exposed us to a whole raft of people around St Albans that we would never have been exposed to.
Exactly, yeah.
From the Civic Society to the Cathedral to councillors to businesses.
Great. Thank you very much, Mike and Caroline.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Take my hand and marry me. But these daughters do not obey. Meet me in the forest and we'll run away.
I'm delighted to welcome to the studio Terry Prince, who has come in a couple of times to talk about books that he enjoyed very much, or the old classic in one case that he remembers from a long time ago. Terry, you've chosen another book, which is interesting because it's historical, but it's very contemporary at the same time. Tell me why you chose this particular book, which, of course, is called Munich.
By Robert Harris. And the reason I chose it, I guess, is because I enjoyed very, very much two previous books of his where he uses the same technique of combining historical fact with imaginative fiction. Those two were An Officer and a Spy, which was about the Dreyfus case in France, and Enigma, which was based around the Bletchley Park codebreakers. In Munich, it's based around the meeting in Munich between Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister at the time, and Hitler, the German Chancellor. This meeting took place in September 1938. You have Chamberlain flying across from Britain to Munich, and Hitler entraining down from Berlin to Munich to meet and discuss something which was partly a result of how the First World War signing off treaties were done. A large part of Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland was predominantly German, and Hitler argued that that should be given back to Germany.
The Nazis never liked the agreement at the end of the First World War, and yep. It was, looking back, it was an unwise way of doing things and the reparations that came with it. And the Sudetenland had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, of course, and then at the end of the First World War, that was divvied up into different countries. And so the creation of Czechoslovakia, which had never existed before, and so that was easy for Hitler to turn and say, well, actually, that should be in Germany. He'd already got Austria by now, hadn't he? He'd created the Austrian and German link through the Anschluss, through taking over without fighting. Mm-hmm. And now he wanted the Sudetenland. Question is, was that where he's going to stop?
Listeners might think, well, they've given it all away. But this is the fascination of the book. We all know how it ended with that famous piece of paper that Chamberlain held aloft when he came back to Britain and declared we now have peace in our time. Well, we all know that we did not have peace in our time. So you might well ask, why bother to read the novel? And the answer is, it's a novel. It's not a piece of historical fact. And what Harris so brilliantly does, I think, is introduce into this his three characters, three star characters, as it were, who he operates alongside the historical feature characters like Chamberlain and Mussolini makes an appearance, and also the French representative, Daladier, and, of course, Hitler himself. And he makes this mix, which results in a page-turner. It reminded me in many ways of, well, his previous novels. We knew how the Dreyfus affair was going to end. We knew about in Enigma, and in Frederick Forsyth's book, The Day of the Jackal, we knew that de Gaulle wasn't, in fact, going to be assassinated. But we still kept reading them because this blend was so skillfully done.
As a book, as an audio book, I mean, we call it a page turner because we start from the page, as it were, but if you're listening to it, you can't stop listening to it.
Do not think you would be reading a dry piece of historical documentation. You won't, because you will get engrossed with the two characters. On the British side, we have Hugh Leggett, who is one of Chamberlain's private secretaries. That's a good move on Harris's part because it means his central character can be appearing in all the key meetings, etc., and thus feed us with the information we need. While he was at Oxford, Leggett made friends with a German called Paul Hartmann, and he has become a German diplomat as a member of the ruling party, but also, and this adds another flavour to the novel, a member of the anti-Hitler resistance that was beginning to build, which we also know didn't succeed. But we want to know. We want to know the book is full of what ifs, I think, yes. Rob, as yes. well, isn't it? Yes. What if the resistance to Hitler had triumphed? What if Chamberlain had taken a different path?
And of course, he's picking on something else that is actually historically true, which is that pre-war, a lot of English and German young people did know each other. There had been a great deal of movement around Europe. A lot of students like that. The younger generation at that time actually did have friends in other countries. Therefore, when war broke out between the two countries, it was often war between friends. And that's quite interesting in this, is these two men knew each other. And there's a third person as well they both knew.
They knew each other as friends at Oxford. And later, they knew a German called Lena, who was, in the first place, the girlfriend of Paul Hartmann, and a very vocal, outspoken opponent of Hitler's plans and methods of action, and in a startlingly vivid piece in the novel, of his private life as well.
We'll come to that in a minute. Let's come to back to Hugh Leggett first, because the book begins with him. It's quite difficult because the mix at the beginning, isn't it? In one sense, he's waiting for something to happen or somebody to come in, but he also mixes up. But tell me about that.
Yeah, I think this opening three pages is absolutely brilliant. In a sense, they're the essence of what Harris does. So you're given a setting in a restaurant in London. You meet this character called Hugh Leggett, who Harris has made up. He's a fictional character who is reading from the newspaper of that day.
I am grateful to Mr. Chamberlain for all his efforts, and I have assured him that the German people want nothing but peace. I have further assured him, and I emphasize it now, that when this problem is solved, Germany has no more territorial problems in Europe. Leggett took out his fountain pen and underlined the passage, and then did the same with another, earlier reference to the Anglo-German naval agreement. Such an agreement is only morally justified if both nations promise one another solemnly never to wage war against one another again. Germany has this will. Let us all hope that those who are of the same will gain the upper hand among the British people. He put aside the paper and checked his pocket watch. It was characteristic of him not to carry the time on his wrist, like most men of his age, but rather on the end of a chain. He was only 28, yet seemed older, his face pale, his manner grave, his suit dark. He had made the reservation a fortnight ago, before the crisis had blown up. Now he felt guilty. He would give her another 5 minutes, then he would have to leave.
So he's reading chunks of reportage of what will be going on in Munich, and the English position on that, and the developing build-up between the meeting of these two powers, England and Germany. At the same time, you get a hint that all is not well in Leggett's own private life. All is not well with his marriage. It's not giving anything away to say that.
Finally, she noticed him, smiled and waved and moved towards him, cutting quickly between the tables in her tight skirt and tailored silk jacket, leaving a wake of turned heads. She kissed him firmly on the mouth. She was slightly out of breath. Sorry, sorry, sorry. It doesn't matter. I only just arrived. Over the past 12 months, he had learned not to ask where she had been. As well as her handbag, she was carrying a small cardboard box. She placed it on the table in front of him and pulled off her gloves. I thought we agreed no presents. He lifted the lid. A black rubber skull, a metal snout, and the vacant glassy eye sockets of a gas mask stared back up at him. He recoiled. I took the children for a fitting. Apparently I'm to put theirs on first. That will test one's maternal devotion, don't you think? She lit a cigarette. Could I have a drink? I'm parched. He signalled to the waiter. Only a half bottle? I have to work this afternoon. Of course you do. I wasn't sure you'd even show. I ought not to have done, to be honest. I tried to call, but you weren't at home. Well, now you know where I was. A perfectly innocent explanation. She smiled and leaned towards him. They clinked glasses. Happy anniversary, darling.
So you're immediately involved in the historical realities of the text and the fictional as well.
You described the position of Hugh Leggett. He's close to Chamberlain. He doesn't know him very well. And a lot of things he discovers himself about Chamberlain, that the characteristics of Chamberlain, the physical movements of Chamberlain, all this comes through quite interestingly because we've seen it on film. We see certain shots of him, but he does always seem to be a terribly sort of Edwardian stiff character. So Harris plays around with these characteristics and develops them for us, and we see it through Leggett's eyes. Meanwhile, over in Germany, Leggett's student friend Paul Hartmann is himself in a slightly different situation, isn't he? Because it's now several years since Hitler's taken over, 33, we're now into 38, 5 years of Nazi rule in Germany. You don't argue much with that. And yet, Hartmann's got something else going on, hasn't he?
Yeah. Hartmann is very near the centre of power. The Nazi centre of power has to tread very, very carefully. He's constantly looking over his shoulder. He's walking on eggshells most of the time, and part of the reason of that is because he's involved with a group who are forming together to bring about Hitler's downfall. We're going to hear an extract where some of the plotters are laying their cards on the table, which itself was a dangerous thing to do because the guy across the table from you may not have been wholly committed to your cause. There was fear and suspicion and mistrust everywhere.
Hartmann took his opportunity to speak. Actually, I can show you the latest proof that Hitler wants war. He reached into his inside pocket and pulled out the text of Hitler's letter to Chamberlain. This is the Führer's response to the British, sent to London earlier tonight. He handed the telegram to Oster, then sat back and lit a cigarette and watched as the letter was passed around. Kott said, "How did you get hold of this?" "I had to take it from the Reich Chancellery to the British Embassy. I made a copy." That was quick work. "Well, this settles it, gentlemen," said Oster when he had finished reading. "There's not a hint of compromise anywhere in it." Beck said, "It's tantamount to a declaration of war."
We know that plots against Hitler, sadly, failed. Again, we're caught in this fascinating kind of situation. We're totally engaged in how Harris takes us by the hand and leads us through these events.
Hartmann, your view? If you want my advice, you should kill the whole filthy lot of them. Himmler, Goebbels, Goering, the entire criminal gang. The violence in his voice surprised him. His fists were clenched. He stopped, conscious of Oster staring at him. My dear Hartmann, usually so detached and ironical. Who knew you carried such hate?
One of the things I found fascinating, and I've not read a biography of Chamberlain, I know very little about him, other than the famous newsreel bits, you know, the piece of paper or what have you, I found the depiction of that man absolutely convincing. And the workings of the diplomacy in the government at the time and the tricky path that they had to tread, perhaps in a more gentlemanly way. But earlier when we were talking, you mentioned the role of Churchill in this, for example.
There's a point in here where it says, I don't want Churchill involved. I don't want Churchill here. Don't let Churchill know. Because, of course, Churchill was a threat. Yeah. Always a fear that he was going to come in and take over, which, of course, he eventually did. There's arguments about Chamberlain, and I'm not a historian, but I do recall that whereas many historians have said, well, he was desperate to avoid war, and that comes through very clearly here. Others have said that he didn't know quite how to play a dictator because we're not terribly good English people at understanding how you play a dictator because they're psychopaths or they're sociopaths. So you can't really work it out. Now, other people said, well, actually, he was playing for time. He wasn't a fool. He knew what was going on. His concern was that we were not rearming fast enough. And so he was playing for time. He got a year of delay. I don't know if that's true. I don't know which story is true. But there certainly have been these arguments. I think Harris is very clear. Here's a man who doesn't want war. After all, he is of a generation which saw the First World War. The whole country has been through that agony. The whole of Europe has been through that, and America, everywhere else. And he doesn't want that to happen again.
And I found that, as I said before, totally convincing. Within the structure of the novel.
Exactly. Because it's not a book. It's a novel.
That has to be made clear. Some of the listeners may have seen The Darkest Hour, the recent film. That certainly impacts on what you've just said about how he was perceived by Chamberlain, this novel. But the more I think about it, the more satisfying as a whole it is. He's made a living out of this combination of historical fact and fiction, and most successfully.
Because he was a journalist. I forget where he began, but I know he ended up as a political editor of the Observer, and he was also on another newspaper as well. He knew how to write in a disciplined way, because journalism has got usually fairly tight space to work in, and he knew how to research, he knew how to move at speed, and I think his Fatherland was his first book, and he said at that point he could give up the day job, buy a house off the millions of copies of Fatherland that were sold, and all he's done since is write his fiction and talk about it. Yeah. It's a skill to be able to take a situation. You think, well, in the case of Munich, we know it all. We've seen it on the films. We know what's going on. And yet we haven't seen it all, because he fictionalises these within this novel. Another one we're talking about, the Conclave, which, of course, is about the election of a new pope. And you think, as you said, well, how can you make a story out of that?
Well, to put it very crudely, a locked room full of old men deciding who's going to be the next pope. I mean, I hope nobody will be offended by that. They're more than old men, obviously. They're prelates. They're high up in the Catholic Church. I had to stop myself turning to the last page to find out who got the job, quite frankly. He's carved out a niche for himself. I don't think he's become lazy about it. It's not just formulaic. He has a formula, yes, but everything I've read of his, The Officer and the Spy, particularly Fatherland, The Enigma, and the one you've just mentioned, Conclave, have been very rich and rewarding reading experiences.
We've talked about two of the principal characters, and we've mentioned the third one, the girl, Layla. Hartman knew her. They were in a relationship. She's got something about her, hasn't she? She's a feisty one.
She's a very feisty young lady. As I said, she's very outspoken. Her behaviour at this meeting that Hitler addresses eventually lands her in trouble. That doesn't put her off. She continues to resist and to vocalise her resistance. And the last meeting we have of her is a very, very painful one. We move from this energetic, vital, outspoken young lady, Hartman's girlfriend, and legates, perhaps?
Yes, that's right. We mustn't go into too much detail, but that is quite painful to read. Right. Yeah. Again, it makes sense within the context in which Harris is writing, because you were either broken by fear that you lived under. You're either broken by that, or you survived it somehow, and there's an argument as different ways in which you can survive. But on the way, she's a feisty young woman who's got a very strong view to it, and she's willing to express it.
Indeed.
Hitler glanced over at the small throng. He must have heard. The stormtroopers certainly had. Their heads had all swung in their direction, but just to make sure, she repeated it. You fucked your niece, you murderer! His face was expressionless. As he climbed into his car, a couple of the SA men broke ranks and started coming towards her. They had short truncheons. Hartman grabbed Lena's arm and pulled her after him. The woman who had told her to shut her filthy mouth tried to block their path. Leggett pushed her out of the way. A man, a big fellow, her husband presumably, swung a punch and caught Leggett just below the eye. The three of them ran out of the square and down a leafy residential road. Hartman and Lena were in front. Leggett could hear the boots of the brown shirts thumping on the cobbles very close behind. His eye was stinging and already beginning to close. His lungs were searing as if they had been pumped full of liquid ice.
We don't want to give away anything, but we can't. There's nothing we can give away. We know that Chamberlain argues with his cabinet, argues with his military, and keeps going back to Hitler to find a solution that will defer, and he's happy to hand over the Sudetenland, after all, it is a far-off country of which we know little. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something similar to that. And that has resonances now. One can again think of other countries that are sort of dismissed as being, well, why do we bother with that? But the end of the story is no. And yet Harris brings it alive, doesn't he?
You know, the only way it could have been more engaging was if he'd stepped off the plane and said, well, actually, I'm going to tear this piece of paper in half. No, he actually says what he's reported as saying. It's the way Harris describes it. And, of course, we are there standing alongside Hugh Leggett and seeing the whole event through his eyes. So Harris is allowed to employ all his skills as a writer in order to colour this famous moment that we all know, where he holds his piece of paper in the hand and believes that he has sued successfully for peace in our time.
I want to thank the British people for what they have done." The crowd cheered again. Someone shouted, "What you have done?" Another called out, "Good old Chamberlain!" "Next, I want to say that the settlement of the Czechoslovak problem, which has been achieved, is, in my view, only a prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler, and here is a paper which bears his name upon it, as well as mine."
It brings together what has been a real clash for Leggett and Hartmann and, in the background, Lena, to go through this experience to square their conscience, their duty to their countries and their responsibilities and their love for each other. And that's all kind of brought together. I should never see that newsreel item in the same way again. I should be looking for Hugh Leggett in the background somewhere, you know.
Thank you very much, Terry.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Well, my thanks to Terry for sharing his thoughts on that novel. Thanks also to Caliber Audio for allowing us to use those extracts from the audiobook. Caliber is a specialist charity providing audiobooks of all sorts and sizes to those who, for reasons of serious sight loss or for some other cause, are unable to read the printed copy. You can find out more about them at caliber.org.uk. The reader on this audiobook was David Rintoul, and the audio version runs for 9.5 hours.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Gilly, Jill, Bob and Fiona. As ever, thank you for listening. Rob will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme. But that's all from me, Bill Redway, in August 2018. We close with the song Up and Down. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.
Oh, I want a page to carry my cloak, and I want a heart on the end of a rope. So bring me flowers, bring me her. Fairy meadow with your words, up and down, up and down. I will lead you up and down, up and down, up and down. I will lead you up and down. Sleep, my love. Obey. Meet me in the forest and we'll run away. Meet me in the forest and we'll run away. Up and down, up and down. I will lead you up and down, up and down, up and down. Swallow of me, all of soul, is what love makes.